two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, are you ready to add a sprinkle of joy to your day? Then you need to check out Add to Cart. Hi, I'm Sujan Pak.
And I'm Kulap Vilaysack. We're your hosts, and on this show, we talk about the things we buy, the things we buy into, and what it says about who we are.
That's right. Each week, we're going to have some honest and maybe, you know, a little TMI conversations about all the fabulous, weird, wonderful things we're adding to or ditching from our carts. You know, we talk about beauty products, latest health trends, philosophies we're passionate about. Nothing is off limits on this podcast.
We're diving deep into everything we and our guests buy into and exploring what it reveals about who we truly are. We're going to decide what's worth the investment, be it money or emotions.
Add to Cart from Lemonada Media has new episodes out on Tuesdays, wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
In hindsight, given, I'm sure you've seen the survey, since the announcement of the pause, vaccine hesitancy is up. We've seen vaccine appointments go unfilled. I know you've made the case that, hey, you know, please look, the fact that we're telling you should give you more confidence, not less. But unfortunately, it appears that it is the reverse. Do you look at how this sort of spiraled out here and wonder if there should have been a different way you guys handled this?
Well, you know, what we do, Chuck, and that's what we keep saying, we leave it to the science. We have the experienced FDA and CDC people who are looking at it and monitoring it. You know, there's one case, then two, three, four. And then when they got to six, they say, we really need to pause. You know, hopefully it'll be a quite temporary pause to do a couple of things. One, examine that hopefully there are not several more out there to alert physicians, stay heads up for this. We're concerned it's a very serious complication, although it is extremely rare, as you well put. You know, you have six cases in close to 7 million people. The other thing about it, Chuck, that's important is that you want to let the physicians out there know who might see women or anybody with this condition that the standard way you would think about treating clots is with the anticoagulant heparin. That would be contraindicated in this case, because heparin could actually make things worse. So there's a twofold reason for doing it. One, to pause and take a look in more detail about it. And two, to make sure that the physicians treat people appropriately.
Welcome to In the Bubble. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Wachter. You just heard Tony Fauci on Meet the Press from last weekend talking about the J&J vaccine and the prospects that it will come back into service. He hinted pretty strongly that it likely will, probably in the next week or so, and almost certainly with some restrictions. Hard to know exactly what they'll be, perhaps only in men, perhaps only in people over 50. We'll just have to see what the investigation shows. But COVID constantly throws curveballs at us, and the J&J is simply the latest one, and we're all processing it. It has slowed down vaccination somewhat, not terribly, but the biggest risk, of course, is if people lose confidence in the J&J vaccine or more broadly lose confidence in vaccinations. Actually, they should feel just the opposite way, because here we are suspending distribution of the J&J vaccine after six terrible cases of very unusual clots, but six cases out of about 7 million people who have been vaccinated, which really does show how well the post-vaccine surveillance system is working and the very, very low threshold that the federal agencies have to slow things down or stop them, hit the pause button to see what's going on before they open things back up. The other reason to hit the pause button was to give physicians like me the opportunity to understand what's going on so that we can recognize it better, as well as the public, so we can all recognize this better and treat it appropriately. So it seems like a reasonable thing to do, although it is it's frustrating, and it is yet another speed bump on our way to full vaccination. It feels like such a big issue that we thought spending an episode talking about it would be worthwhile. And we were lucky to get as our guest John Moore, who's a PhD professor of microbiology and immunology at Weill Cornell Medicine, and really one of the nation's leading experts on vaccines. You probably have seen him quoted in the media or seen him on television or radio. He's been quite active, and you'll see why. He's a very thoughtful, actually very funny and charming gentleman who takes some very complicated concepts and explains them, I thought, extremely well. While I had John, I thought it was also too good an opportunity not to talk a little bit about vaccines versus variants, a little bit about his main work, which is the HIV vaccine, and why that has been so hard, whereas finding vaccines for COVID or several vaccines for COVID was comparatively far easier. And we also ended the episode talking a little bit about vaccine passports. And as you'll see, John is quite passionate about that issue. So I enjoyed the conversation. I think you will, too. And so let us ring up John Moore. John, thank you so much for doing this. Can you start by explaining how the J&J and the AstraZeneca vaccines work and how that's different than the mRNA, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines work?
Well, the J&J and AstraZeneca vaccines are both based on adenovirus vectors, which are common cold viruses that have been engineered to express the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. And they cause transient infections of the people immunized with these vaccines. And when the adenovirus enters target cells, the adenovirus proteins are produced, and also the engineered SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. And the host responds to both adenovirus proteins, which are immunogenic, and also the SARS-CoV-2 S protein, which is the one we're interested in as the basic principle of the vaccination program, which is to induce antibodies to the spike protein and also cellular immunity. But most emphasis has been on the antibody response. And the adenovirus vectors do this perfectly well. The mRNAs achieve the same goal, but in a different way. They contain no adenovirus components. They're simply, the mRNA expresses only the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. So there are no other components that are notably or known to be immunogenic. So in that sense, it's a cleaner antibody response. And we all know the efficacy trial results. The Moderna and Pfizer mRNAs were in the mid-90s for efficacy against COVID. The Johnson & Johnson US trial was in the 70s, depends on how you cut it and where the results were, et cetera, but it's somewhat lower efficacy, but it's still strongly protective against serious disease, which is the most important parameter. Protection against mild COVID is great, but it's not as important as protecting against hospitalization, severe disease, and death. So up until a few weeks ago, everything looked pretty rosy, and then we hit the Johnson & Johnson side effects problem that is still being actively investigated. And around the same time, or a little earlier in fact, the Europeans found what seemed to be pretty similar problems with the AstraZeneca. And these same problems have not been seen with Pfizer and Moderna, so it's pretty reasonable assumption that they're adenovirus vector specific, and now we need to figure out exactly what's going on so that the right decisions can be made for the future use of these vaccines, or not, as the case may be.
Yeah. You mentioned that the adenovirus vector, so it's sort of carrying the part that we really care about, the spike protein, but you say it is immunogenic, it creates an immune response. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it's an inevitable thing. We have antibody responses to adenoviruses because they're fairly common in society. I mean, we've all been exposed to adenoviruses over our life, so we have antibody responses. The adenovirus vectors that were chosen by J&J and AstraZeneca are atypical. So the AstraZeneca one uses a chimpanzee adenovirus vector that we've never been exposed to. And the Johnson & Johnson uses adenovirus 26, which is a very rare serotype that most people haven't encountered. But once immunized with these new vectors, you will raise antibody responses to them. And that can be, for the second immunization in the AstraZeneca program, that may actually be dose limiting. It may reduce the immunogenicity of the second dose. The Russians, with their Sputnik V vaccine, which appears, assuming the data are kosher, to have higher efficacy, combines two different vectors, two different adenovirus vectors. One is AD5 and the other is AD26. And that is designed and seems to be effective at reducing the dose-limiting initial response to the initial adenovirus injection impacting on the second. So it seems to be a cleaner design for a two-dose. But there we are. At the moment, Johnson & Johnson is being used as a one-dose vaccine, although a two-dose trial is still ongoing and hasn't reported yet in the USA.
So one of the things that's true in clinical medicine, I imagine, and your work in science too, is when you see something that's unusual, you're looking at not only the statistics on that thing, but also the scientific plausibility. Was this a thing I worried about in the beginning? And if it was, then it's more likely that it's a real effect. When you heard about these clots, maybe first from AstraZeneca and then from J&J, was your instinct that, wow, this is really weird, I can't imagine how that could happen? Or your instinct was, yeah, I could see how that might actually happen?
Well, rare events happen in vaccine trials, and when you're immunizing, you know, tens to hundreds of millions of people, rare events are going to pop up. And what is important is determining, are they real and vaccine related, or are they just rare events? I mean, we heard early on, you know, man in 50s has Moderna vaccine injection, goes home, dies of heart attack. Well, men in 50s sometimes go home and die of a heart attack. It's nothing to do with the Moderna vaccine injection. So you have to tune out coincident events and try to identify what's really linked to the vaccines. Then it becomes a numbers game. And there were sufficient cases in Europe to raise red flags with the investigators and trigger the EMA to investigate. And when the same or what seems to be the same phenomenon happens with Johnson & Johnson in the USA, and they're both adenovirus vectors and the same responses are not being seen with the mRNAs, then, you know, it's a reasonable assumption to point fingers at a response to the adenovirus components and try and understand what's going on. So I think there probably is something real, and it needs to be understood. And a real, very rare event is either going to be serious enough to curtail the use of the vaccine, or it's going to be manageable by finding ways to still use it and minimize the risk to people. And, you know, one factor we've learned is that most of the people who've suffered these rare side effects are women of childbearing age. Men seem to be much less affected statistically, which does have potentially some medical explanation. Women are more prone to autoimmune reactions than men. So my son got Johnson & Johnson, and I didn't bat an eyelid. I thought, well, one, it's an incredibly rare event, and two, he's male. If my daughter had got it, I might have been a bit more nervous in last week.
As you say, that, you know, the idea that a rare side effect may crop up and we may not see it until 100,000 or a million or 10 million people have been vaccinated is credible. How about blood clots? From other vaccines in the past, was unusual blood clots in weird places, was that on your list of the things that you were particularly worried about when we're mucking around with the human immune system?
I haven't seen reports of these blood clots in other adenovirus vector trials. I mean, my background is HIV vaccines, and adenovirus vectors have been used for several years in humans. As a J&J have a large phase 2B efficacy type trial for an HIV vaccine going on in southern Africa at the moment. But these are small scale trials. I mean, by small scale, I mean, they're typical of efficacy trials that a few tens of thousands of people, which, so a one in a million event just wouldn't register. Same when these vectors were used in Ebola and Zika trials, they're not large scale enough to detect a one in a million rare event. So there was nothing on my radar screen, and I've not heard other people saying that this was a foreseeable risk. I think it came out of the blue.
Yeah. And what is your and the latest thinking on the mechanism? What seemed it, assuming this is a real association, not a coincidence, which I agree with you, it seems more likely than not it's real, although very, very rare. What would be the trigger to make this happen?
Well, we don't have a lot of information, and there hasn't been much time. And obviously the Europeans have had longer, and a couple of European papers appeared in New England Journal at the end of last week, and they both pointed the fingers at antibody response to platelet factor 4, which would be sufficient to interfere with blood clotting systems. I don't know the mechanism. I'm not even sure it's been out. What is that triggered by? It's not known. Is it a response to an adenovirus component that leads to cross-reactivity with PF4? It's plausible, but not known. The Russians, who are never short of issuing press releases that promote their own agenda, put one out last week saying, we don't think this is going to happen with Sputnik V because we purify our vaccine incredibly well, i.e. the implication is you guys don't, which may not be true. And they're saying that it's the anti-PF4 is triggered by contaminant DNA in the adenovirus preparations. Well, that may or may not be true. And that, again, needs to be looked into. So it's just too early, I think, to have any certainty about what's going on. But the consensus appears to be building that it's some kind of host antibody response to a key component of the platelet and blood clotting system.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few, and of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you think the decision to pause was prudent?
I think it was inevitable. You have to look at the counterfactual. What would have happened if the FDA and CDC had done nothing? And then the word leaked out, it went around that there were these deaths or serious cases and the FDA and CDC were doing nothing about it. There would have been a bit of a media firestorm. And so the question is, what is the least damaging path forward, and how do you minimize the effect on public confidence? Because in the end, that's the bigger picture. If the public becomes scared of these vaccines, then we're in big trouble for vaccinating our way against the pandemic. It was clearly a very difficult situation, and it's probably not ideal that this pause is just going on. I don't see why the relevant committees can't meet almost on a daily Zoom and review data as it emerges and decide, you know, rather than waiting for 10 days or 2 weeks or whenever the meeting is, can we not do this more efficiently? Can the CDC and FDA not issue guidance to, for example, say that these vaccines are appropriate for men or older women, but not for younger women, which would be what the data are currently pointing to? But honestly, I'm glad I didn't have to make that kind of decision. I think it's tricky.
Yeah, it's incredibly tricky. I'm not surprised, and I agree with you. I think the initial decision was good. I think waiting a week seems like an awful long time, and this seems like it's urgent, if not emergent, to sort this out. Is that what your crystal ball tells you, that they will reapprove it and limit the types of people that can and can't get it?
Well, Tony Fauci gave a very strong hint over the weekend, and if there's anyone who's in a loop, it's Tony, and he essentially said that the likelihood is that the vaccines will be approved for subgroups, and I don't think he specified it, but it's pretty obvious what he means. And also guidance is given to hospital physicians nationwide on what to look for and what to do and not, because apparently heparin, which would be a standard treatment in this kind of circumstance, actually makes this particular condition worse. So, you know, you don't treat what you would normally treat with heparin, and that's really not a good idea. So physicians are now being told to be on their guard not to give heparin to anyone who presents with clotting disorders within a couple of weeks of a J&J shot.
Yeah, I think the issue is that heparin can cause something quite similar to this. It's the cases that I've seen that look like this, where the platelets are activated and cause clots in unusual places, are usually caused by heparin, which is this kind of mind-blowing thing when you're using heparin to thin the blood. And so it's prudent to stay away from it and favor other blood thinners and other treatments. At this point, I think you mentioned there's no signal that the Moderna or Pfizer vaccines have any of the same problem. Is that scientifically plausible? Is that what you would expect, that because the platforms are so different, there's no good reason to think they would cause similar problems?
Yeah. Again, it's a two versus two. We have two adenovirus vectors that seem to have a similar problem, two mRNAs that don't seem to have a similar problem. Probably something to do with the adenovirus vector itself, or a contaminant if the Russians are right. So it's not been reported in the mRNAs, which have been in larger numbers of people, and hundreds of millions of people in Israel, in Europe, in the States, and these have just not been reported. And so it's hard to imagine they're suddenly going to appear. They look to be very clean from this perspective.
If you had gotten the J&J vaccine, and there are about 7 or 8 million Americans that have, would you be worried right now?
Personally, no, not at all. I'm not in the bigger risk group, and I don't kind of worry about things I can't control. If it happens, it happens. But I wouldn't be spending my life fretting about it. No, I think it's just an incredibly rare event. And if any individual who is in the, you know, within 2 weeks of J&J, and we're pretty much out of the window now, should be on the lookout for the symptoms that have been reported. You know, stomach upsets, sore legs, anything associated with thrombosis, any signs of brain malfunction, you know, inability to think, concentrate, anything serious that would be, they should immediately go and see a physician. But I personally wouldn't be agonizing over it at this point now.
Yeah. And we had a couple of vaccine experts on about a month ago, and I posed the question, often the question gets framed, if you could get the J, this is pre-clot, before we knew of this problem, if you could get the J&J now, or would have to wait a few weeks or a month for Pfizer or Moderna, which would you choose? And the answer is always, you know, you get whichever one you can get quickly. But then I asked them, if all three were available and equally accessible to you, which would you prefer? And both of them said the J&J. And mainly because of the ease of use in a single shot and one and done. And they weren't bothered by that mild difference in efficacy, because the big efficacy number that we care about, which is how protected they are around getting very sick and dying, is comparable. First of all, how did you feel a month ago, and how has that changed, if at all? If you were given a choice, let's assume next week the J&J is reapproved, but not for women under age 50. And you're not in that group, and you have a choice of any of the three. Does this change your thinking about which one you would take?
I think a lot depends on your individual circumstances. To me, one dose versus two dose just wasn't a factor. I mean, I have the privilege of working in a medical school. It would not be difficult to go for two doses. I would go for the Pfizer on the grounds it's the most potent, or equally potent to Moderna, and is slightly less reactogenic. In fact, I'm in the Novavax phase 3 efficacy trial, and I get my crossover phase tomorrow. So I may have got the placebo a month ago or 2 months ago. And tomorrow, if I got the placebo, I'll get my first active shot, or vice versa. It's a crossover. So in fact, my immediate family will get four different vaccines. My wife got Pfizer, my daughter got Moderna, my son got J&J, and I'll be in Novavax. So I think that may actually make us a literally unique family in America.
That's really impressive. So I have a couple questions. But first of all, when you say the Pfizer has less immunogenicity, so for folks that react to genetics, so that means less likely to cause you to feel crummy the day or two after the vaccine?
Yeah, I think there's enough data to say that there's, I mean, it's a mild difference. It's not something that should matter to people. But the Moderna vaccine is 100 micrograms of mRNA per dose, and Pfizer is 30. And it looks like Moderna went for a bit of overkill, and that's probably the wrong word, but they biased on the upside, and 30 micrograms is sufficient, and that is associated with slightly fewer minor adverse events, headaches, and whatever. So if you're given an absolutely straight choice, which you're not, and it's a distinction without a difference in practice, yeah, I would have chosen Pfizer over anything else.
And interesting, even though it's more powerful, and you say that maybe causes some problems in terms of reaction, your sense is it doesn't cause any difference, and the data doesn't support any difference in terms of its ultimate effectiveness as a vaccine.
No. And in fact, Moderna did a dose change study recently. They halved the dose in a phase 1 trial and showed that the antibody response was the same as the original dose. So they can use 50 instead of 100 micrograms and get essentially exactly the same antibody response. And this isn't a criticism. I mean, this time last year when they were designing the trials, normally in a you know, non-pandemic crisis, you would do dose ranging studies and identify by experimentation the most appropriate dose to use, but they didn't have the time. So the two companies made best guesses, educated best guesses, and they didn't get it. They both got it about right. But it turns out that Pfizer probably got it righter than Moderna. And then that's not a criticism. It's an inevitable consequence of the kind of situation we were living in this time last year.
Yeah, interesting. Maybe you can explain something to me that I've had a hard time explaining to people, knowing very little about vaccinology and immunology. I tell people when they have a really crummy day after the vaccine that they should be glad that is the vaccine working and it's doing its thing. And then when they have no reaction, they say, well, maybe it didn't work in me. And I say, no, the reaction, the level of the reaction has nothing to do. And you're just as vaccinated as you would be if you'd had a reaction. Those two things seem to be in conflict. And I find myself doing a little hand waving when I describe it. Can you tell us why that's true, if it is?
Your reaction is perfectly logical. You would think there would be a connection, but studies were done in the phase 3 or post phase 3 to look at whether there was any correlation between sore arm and antibody titer, and it wasn't found. There is no correlation. There's no predictive value. So I don't know if it's known why. I don't know why, but there is no predictive value. And, you know, different people respond in different ways to vaccines in general. When I get my annual flu shot, which I don't always get, but I certainly have been recently, I never notice it. I don't get a sore arm for the annual flu shot. The only reason I know I've been stuck is I got a piece of sticking plaster on my arm in the shower next day.
Mm-hmm.
But other people say, oh, I don't like it. It gives me a sore arm, to which you say, oh, come on, grow up. I mean, but different people respond in different ways. We're an outbred population.
Yeah. But the key point is that the lack of that kind of response to it doesn't mean that it didn't work. It's just as likely that it has worked. You mentioned that your work has been in HIV vaccines, which is a hard field. But one of the things I've pointed out to people who don't really understand how miraculous it was that we went from a new virus to wildly effective vaccines in 10 or 11 months, that really smart people and a whole lot of funding has gone into trying to find an HIV vaccine for, I guess, about 40 years, and we're not there. Describe that battle, and why has that been so hard?
Yeah, I've become a long-term non-progressor. It's it's a challenging field. It's not one where you get instant gratification. It's a long haul, grinding out incremental progress, you know. Sometimes it's an increment, more often it's an excrement. I mean, you just have to gut it out and stick with it until it's time to retire and maybe some smarter people finish the job. The coronaviruses turn out to be a lot easier to immunize against. I mean, really, it's no comparison. The HIV variability I mean, we may talk about variants and they're a fact of life now with coronaviruses, but with HIV, it's just orders of magnitude more problematic. HIV varies essentially on a daily basis, whereas with coronaviruses, we're talking about months to years for the same, you know, timescale, for the same degree of variation. Plus, coronaviruses have this, you know, site of vulnerability. It's sort of a jargon term. It's the point at which they are most vulnerable to antibody attack. And it's sitting out there like a sore thumb, sticking out there saying, hit me. Whereas, and that's the receptor binding domain on the spike protein. And that's what most neutralizing antibodies are raised against. There are other domains, but most of them are against the RBD, sometimes called the notorious RBD. You know, we don't have an equivalent in the HIV spike protein. It's a much more shielded receptor binding domain. It's much more difficult for antibodies to get at. That, you know, it's a different beast. And it's just, and of course, HIV's virology and pathogenesis are more problematic than coronaviruses. Everything about HIV is difficult.
Yeah.
You know, we would not have succeeded last year in making a vaccine if the new virus had been anything like HIV. And that's why there was a fair amount of skepticism about whether or not this these programs would achieve. We didn't know enough this time last year to say confidently, yes, we'll have a vaccines that are approved by the end of 2020, which, you know, was an amazing accomplishment. But it was also not built on nothing. I mean, all of these technologies were recycled, repurposed from existing vaccine programs. I mean, the adenovirus vectors had been used for HIV, Zika, Ebola. mRNAs have been around for a decade, less well used, but certainly not a brand new technology. There were the VRC was in a position, BioNTech in Germany was in a position to exploit existing designs to tweak them for the coronaviruses. Protein subunits with adjuvants is, again, a proven technology. It could be exploited by Novavax, and multiple other companies are now in that space. So all of these methodologies could be rapidly exploited in a time of pandemic to come up with new designs that turn out to work extremely well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the important point that even though we have not yet found the magic HIV vaccine, we have learned a lot from that effort, and some of that turned out to be useful for COVID. Do you think it's going to go the other way? Are there things that we're learning from the COVID vaccine work that may turn out to be useful for HIV, or we already knew everything that we know with HIV and it just turns out to be a really hard problem?
Well, mRNA HIV vaccine programs are being emphasized. It's not that they didn't exist, but they're now being prioritized by several well-funded groups, including the VRC, to see if that will make a difference. I think it might be useful. I don't think it's sufficient because the immunogenicity problems of the HIV spike exist however you present it, but it's certainly relevant technologies, and some of the designs are going to be impressive. I mean, I'm not going to get into the technicalities on a COVID talk, but it could be a useful contribution. And, you know, everything, knowledge is always translatable. I mean, a lot of the fantastic immunology of COVID is based on methodologies that were established for other viral infections, including influenza and HIV. I mean, the investment, you know, the country's investment in science over the past several decades becomes incredibly valuable when you really need it in a pandemic. It's all the more reason to continue to support NIH and other federal and charity programs in the sciences, because when you need them, they better be around.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts between Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her A-plus guests on Wiser Than Me, laugh along with Elise Myers as she and her guests play a rapid-fire questions game on Funny 'Cause It's True, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week, we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive. From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together. This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between. Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us. So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
So you mentioned the variants. Let's pivot a little bit to talking about your current thinking about the, it seems like the vaccine versus variants question has been the dominant theme of the last couple of months. So where do you think we're landing today? Are we winning that battle or not?
I think it's too early to tell. We're not certainly losing it, but we've not won it. I mean, variants, you know, they're on the radar screens most of this year. But in fact, the first variant arose in March, April 2020. It's called D614G. It arose most probably in ski resort areas in Italy, you know, Italy, Switzerland, something around that part of Europe. And it is more transmissible as a variant, not by a huge amount, but by enough that it would overtake the original Wuhan strain and become the dominant strain worldwide within about 6 months, 4 months. So that, and that's the virus that until at the end of this year dominated the US pandemic. It wasn't the original Wuhan strain. The Wuhan strain was replaced by D614G. And we got a bit complacent, I think, about that because it was a bit more transmissible, but it had no impact for antibody responses. And then you can only find variants if you're looking for them. And the Brits have done this particularly well. The Brits have done a lot of things very badly. Now, I'm British heritage and I can criticize my old country all I like. But what they did do extremely well was have very good genetic surveillance systems that tracked sequence evolution. And they found a highly transmissible variant called B117 that emerged in Kent, a county in southeast England. Dominated the UK pandemic, spread to Europe, spread to other countries. It obviously entered the USA, and it's now probably the dominant strain in the USA. And it spreads more rapidly. It's something like 60% more contagious. People with it seem to produce virus for longer, and it has a higher affinity for the ACE2 receptor, and that's probably contributing. It may be infecting kids more easily. It's different reports suggest it either is or is not more lethal. There were a couple of reports that said it's 60% more lethal for people who get it. Recently, there have been a couple of other reports that says, well, maybe not, so we're not sure. But it's not antibody resistant, or not to an important extent. So it's not going to have an impact on vaccine efficacy. We're pretty confident about that. The more troubling variants for vaccine efficacy are B1351, which arose in South Africa, and P1 that's in came from Brazil. And there's a New York variant, B1526, that has the same mutations. There's a new one in India that seems to be dominating the Indian pandemic, B1617, and that's also got troubling mutations. And they create a degree of antibody resistance. Now, what we're unsure about is how that translates into any reductions in vaccine efficacy. I think the consensus is that it will not knock out vaccine efficacy. It's not a wipeout, but there could be some degree of compromise that we could take 90% down to 75%. I mean, I'm not exactly plucking numbers from the air, but nor am I stating them with confidence. They're models, projections. Mm-hmm. So, but probably again, protection against severe disease and death would still be in place. So there would, you'd perhaps get mild COVID, but wouldn't die with one of these variants if you've been fully vaccinated. But, you know, B1351 in South Africa was sufficient to take out the AstraZeneca vaccine completely. I mean, the AstraZeneca vaccine failed completely in South Africa in the face of B1351. So these variants, they're called variants of concern, and they're not called variants of mass panic. They're called variants of concern, and that's because we are concerned about them. But, you know, most of the virology and vaccine community is not freaking out. We're monitoring this, and vaccine manufacturers are redesigning the vaccines to try to adjust the composition to, for example, make a new mRNA or a new protein vaccine or a new adenovirus vector that incorporates the sequence not of the original Wuhan strain, but of B1351, so that we can raise antibody responses to that variant and boost protection. And there have been a couple of trials, not really reported, just known about, of B1351 variants. I think Moderna has done it, Novavax has done it, and the antibody responses look encouraging. There was a recent paper out of Sweden in an animal model, monkey experiment. The results looked encouraging. So now these new variant vaccines are being, well, they've been designed, they're being tested. They can be produced in large amounts, and if we need them later in the year as an additional boost, they're going to be available because we've had time to plan. Unlike this time in 2020, we didn't have time to plan. This time in 2021, you can see what's evolving and you can take steps to deal with it. And that's, again, science in action.
And is your crystal ball say that that will be what happens this fall or sometime next year? We will be getting another shot and it will be a rejiggered vaccine against the vaccine, potentially vaccine resistant variants?
I think it's plausible. I mean, the question is how much these vaccine resistant or relatively resistant variants spread in America. At the moment, B117 appears to be squelching them out, which, you know, in one sense is a good thing. And it's all a competition for space in the human population. These virus variants are all competing with each other for dominance, and the one with the most transmissibility will dominate. Might change in the vaccinated population. If everyone's vaccinated, then a resistant virus has a selective advantage and may become dominant. So, you know, the CEO of Pfizer last week said he's anticipating a third boost with the Pfizer vaccine for Pfizer vaccine recipients. I assume the Moderna CEO would say the same thing. Whether mm-hmm. that would be a third dose with the existing vaccine or a third dose with a variant vaccine, I think remains to be determined. But it's prudent to plan for both eventualities and see how the situation evolves later this year or next year.
It's so remarkable. I you know, finding ourselves rooting for the UK 117 variant to win this race when it's a much nastier virus than the original version. But just it seems like the dominant issue now is the vaccine resistant issue. And so even a more infectious and more virulent virus is still better than a vaccine resistant virus in our future.
Yeah, the most troubling variant that we've seen is the South African B1351 because it's greater transmissibility. And it dominated, once it appeared in South Africa, it rapidly dominated the pandemic. It replaced the previous common virus, and it's antibody resistant. The P1 from Brazil is sort of South Africa light. It doesn't quite have the same degree of resistance, but it's causing a lot of problems in Brazil. So none of these is good variants, but purely from the vaccine resistance perspective, B117 is not as scary.
It's not exactly your field, but I know you've thought about the issue of immunity verification or authentication or passports. Just from where you live as an immunologist and a vaccine expert, do you think it's a good idea or a bad idea as we plot what life is going to be like over the summer?
I think it's a good idea. I think it could help. So, you know, variants are obviously a big problem that we're all wising up to and trying to come up with solutions to, and it's rooted in science. But the fact that a very significant fraction of Americans simply refuse to be vaccinated and refuse to be mask wearers because the two track is a very worrying dynamic. And it's concentrated among Republican voters in red states. If up to 40-50% of Republicans are refusing to take vaccines, we'll never be able to vaccinate the country out of a crisis. And, you know, the irony here is that the people who most, you know, rant on about freedom, I want my freedom back, are the people who are least willing to do what is necessary to regain that freedom. I mean, that rant that Jim Jordan did against Tony Fauci in Congress last week was, you know, epitomized the nature of the problem. He wants his life and his constituents' life to go back fully to normal, but he won't act as a leader and give the advice to his constituents and other people who listen to him to go and get vaccinated, because that is the best way back to the freedom you want to have. And this is a, you know, Fox News, which obviously I don't watch, but I read about, as full of people questioning vaccines and emphasizing all the negatives and not emphasizing the positives. And we're in this incredibly polarized society that vaccines are rejected by a significant number of people, not on true concerns grounds, but on political grounds. And it's a government intervention, therefore it's bad. Well, if you put in corporate imposed vaccine passports, it's not going to happen at government level. There's a certainty that the Biden administration will not do this. But if corporate America says, you want to use our services, get vaccinated. You want to get on a plane, show your vaccine passport, your vaccine confirmation certificate, along with your boarding pass. And then if you're a vaccine refusenik and you want to fly from California to New York, well, your option is get vaccinated or rent a car and drive yourself. You want to go on a cruise, or do you want to watch the boat depart from the dock, just standing there watching? You want to go to a NASCAR event? Well, get vaccinated. If not, you watch it on TV. I mean, you know, it's a choice. Do the right thing and get vaccinated or not. You know, I think something like this could drive people. It might sound coercive, but it might drive more people into getting vaccinated and help end the pandemic. I mean, it sounds a pretty desperate measure, but if we end up with 40% of the country simply not vaccinated, we will not naturally end the pandemic. We will see more variants arise, and we'll be having this conversation in a year's time. So radical solutions are going to have to be considered, or we don't have a way out of the pandemic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is immensely complicated, and I am grateful to you for explaining it beautifully. All of these tensions, you know, many of us knew very little about anything in immunology, vaccinology, virology until a year ago, and it's hard for even for me as a physician truly understanding all of it. You've done a terrific job explaining it, and really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I always enjoy intelligent conversations. If it can help educate the public, we've had to do a lot of it this year. We do it with family, we do it with friends, we do it with, you know, contacts, we do it with the media. And it makes you think. And, you know, explaining things to people who can pass along accurate information is part of our jobs. And I think we're all happy to do it.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again to John Moore for a really interesting conversation about the J&J vaccine, but much more about the different issues with vaccinations, and particularly the tension between vaccines versus variants. And again, I was really struck by John's passion about potentially using vaccine authentication or vaccine passports. I think that comes from someone who's been spending his life working on trying to find effective vaccines, and how frustrating it has been to not find a vaccine for HIV after we've been working on that for 40 years. So now that we have found, really miraculously found several safe and effective vaccines for COVID that can get us out of this pickle that we're in, the fact that a fairly large slice of the American public seems unwilling to be vaccinated is, I think you could tell in his voice, immensely frustrating, and we're all looking for solutions to that. Obviously, the best solution would be education and people understanding the relative risks, the safety of these vaccines, the efficacy of these vaccines, and making a good choice. But if that doesn't work, I'm with John. I think it's reasonable to consider having vaccine passports and limiting access to certain things based on your vaccination status. But that debate will not go away anytime soon. As I've predicted for months, that is going to be the hot issue for the summer. We have a number of other great episodes coming up here on In the Bubble. We'll talk to Nikki Lorre, who ran pandemic preparedness under the Obama administration and now has a senior role in working on vaccinations at a global level. We've spent a lot of time on the show talking about the domestic situation as it comes to vaccines and variants and more. Not very much time in the last several months talking about the global scene. And the global scene is critically important, not only on ethical and human grounds, but as has been said almost to the point of cliche, if we're not successful in vaccinating the globe, we here in the United States will not ultimately be safe because we'll see more cases imported and ultimately more variants. So really interesting discussion with Nick and Lori. We'll also talk to John Halamka. John is one of the nation's experts on technological transformation in healthcare. And we'll spend some time thinking with John about how COVID has accelerated the digital transformation of healthcare. In his role leading that work at the Mayo Clinic, he really is at the leading edge of thinking about how to take advantage of artificial intelligence, telemedicine, sensors, all sorts of new tools that now are available to us, and we have to figure out how to use it in the service of improving patient care and also cutting costs. And John will describe what's happened during COVID and where that might lead us as we come out of the pandemic. Finally, we'll have a terrific show on COVID and health equity. We'll have three guests. One, Rhea Boyd, will talk about particular issues around equity, including equity as it pertains to vaccination in Black populations. We'll also have Diane Havler and John Jacobo. Diane is a colleague of mine at UCSF. John is a community activist in San Francisco, and they have partnered to do some remarkable things in both testing and vaccination in the Mission District, the Latinx District in San Francisco. It's really an inspiring story, and I think you'll enjoy hearing that episode. Look forward to having you join us on In the Bubble for these upcoming episodes. Until then, I hope you get vaccinated. Please stay safe, and we will talk soon. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Chrissy Pease and Alex McGowan produced our show. Our mix is by Ivan Kuriev. Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax executive produced the show. Our theme was composed by Dan Molad and Oliver Hill, and additional music by Ivan Kuriev. You can find out more about our show on social media at In the Bubble Pod. Until next time, stay safe and stay sane. Thanks so much for listening.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people, and we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Feeling decision fatigue about what to make for dinner? We get it. I'm Jane Black.
And I'm Liz Dunn. We're veteran food journalists, and as parents ourselves, we know how hard it can be to feed your family.
That's why we created Pressure Cooker, a podcast that offers practical strategies for navigating the marketing madness and cultural expectations around mealtime.
Each week, we'll check in with the experts. From social media diet trends to baby-led weaning and AI meal planning, we have all your food-related questions covered.
Listen to Pressure Cooker wherever you get your podcasts.